Well, a couple of weeks ago, we started a short series in Romans chapter 1, verses 16 to 17. At the time, we talked about the fact that those verses, just two verses, but those were instrumental in Martin Luther's awakening to the gospel. And last week, I pointed out that October 31st is not just Halloween, which it is, but it's also recognized as the day that the Protestant Reformation began. It's the date that Martin Luther nailed 95 theses in dispute of indulgences to the door of the church in Wittenberg. And last week we saw that if Luther were to pinpoint one verse that was most instrumental in his theological understanding, it'd be Romans chapter 1, verse 17. He says that when he came to understand the righteousness of God as described in Romans 1:17, and these are his words, the whole of Scripture took on a new meaning. And whereas before the justice of God had filled me with hate, now it became to me inexpressibly sweet in greater love. This passage of Paul became to me a gate to heaven. So I thought that it would be appropriate for us, in conjunction with that anniversary, to look at this verse and its predecessor, Romans 1, verse 16 and 17, so we can understand more fully what it is that makes us who we are. The passage there speaks of the righteousness of God that is revealed in the gospel. And last week we honed in on Luther's understanding of that righteousness, that it is not God's judging righteousness, a measurement by which we are impossibly short. Instead, this is God's saving righteousness, whereby we are infused with the righteousness of Christ. It's an alien righteousness, a righteousness that is not our own, but given to us. God does for us what we can't do ourselves. And the passage says that this righteousness is by faith from first to last. And to make his case, Paul has this quote from the Old Testament, a passage from Habakkuk, in the chapter that I read earlier today, which says, the righteous will live by faith. So today, I want to unpack what that means, what Paul came to understand Habakkuk's quote there being used to defend what it means to place our faith for the righteousness of God to be ours. So what I want to do is I want to start back in Habakkuk, which is where Paul used this as a source of his understanding. And then we'll work our way forward to Romans, because I think Habakkuk will shed some helpful light on what Romans has to teach us. So if you have your Bibles, you can turn to Habakkuk. We'll be kind of scanning through that book as we go. It's a short book, just three chapters long. And in it, Habakkuk and God are having a dialogue. Habakkuk was troubled, back in chapter 1, that begins with Habakkuk being troubled by the ungodliness that he saw in Israel. He saw violence and injustice, strife, conflict, wrongdoing, and he wondered how long he would have to wait for God to intervene in that, because it seemed like the law was paralyzed, as it says in verse 4 there. Lifeless, immobile. It wasn't operating well. A law with no enforcement, just inviting abuse. Without policing, the Israelites, they feel like they can drive as fast as they want on the freeway. Speed limit, speed limit. No one's going to pull them over anyway. But God replies that the Israelites' wickedness has not gone unnoticed. And he says that he's about to use the Babylonians to punish the Israelites. Oh, great. Okay, Israel is full of lawbreakers. Habakkuk recognizes that, but compared to the Babylonians, well, they're saintly. Bad enough that they've been living without policing for all this time. But is it really any better to have a police force that's corrupt to the core? I mean, yeah, the law is paralyzed, but maybe a paralyzed law is better than this legal topsy-turvy where righteousness is being enforced by these scoundrels, the Babylonians. God replies that the Israelites' wickedness has not gone unnoticed, and now he's going to offer this as a solution, the Babylonians. That doesn't sit well with Habakkuk. So he questions God. Is God really doing right? Which seems a bit audacious, but this wicked swallowing up the righteous, that doesn't seem right in Habakkuk's eyes. God's answer is that he is not unaware of the Babylonians' guilt either. He's not blind to their wickedness. He knows that they are puffed up and that their desires are not upright and that they will be judged for their wickedness in due time. Just because God uses them as an implement of judgment against Israel doesn't mean that they are immune from judgment themselves. They're not the ones that are really policing this injustice. It's God. And he can use whoever he wants to bring that enforcement. And this is what sets up the contrast, the counterpoint to the Babylonians that generates this quote from Paul that he uses in Romans. This one, Babylon, with this inflated ego, it's all puffed up and corrupt desires, is set in contrast to the righteous one who will live by faith. And most of the rest of the chapter, Habakkuk chapter 2, is related to the judgment that will fall on unrighteous Babylonians. They will get theirs in due time. But verse after verse of this judgment is counterbalanced by this one simple statement about the righteous ones. They will live by faith. And our understanding of what it means to live by faith is informed, at least in part, by this contrast. We see faith more clearly when we understand it as the antithesis of the unrighteous lifestyle that's being condemned. So what I want to point out is in the rest of the chapter, Habakkuk 2, it's filled with five woes that are declared. Five woes proclaimed against the unrighteous Babylonians in verses 6 through 20, each a different shade of unrighteousness. And as we fill in this picture of unrighteousness, it'll help us to see what it means by contrast to live a life of faith. So the first woe is in verses 6 through 8, and it speaks of greed. These are a greedy people. The Babylonians are piling up stolen goods. They'll use whatever means necessary to put a few extra bucks in their pocket. And this is going to end up coming back to bite them. So it says in verse 8 that the ones that they have plundered will turn around and plunder them. They'll get a scoop of their own cooking. See how they like the taste of this bitter dish. The second woe comes in verse 9 through 11, and this relates to pride. The Babylonians are setting their nest on high. They are building a stronghold. This walled fortress is like a protection from ruin. They're building a safety net, like protecting themselves against any unforeseen developments. This is their insurance plan. They're building a safe place to retreat to. It's this self-reliant pride that's on display. They'll protect themselves, ensure their own security. But to do so, it tells us that they are trampling on all these people to get there. And the very walls that they are building will testify against them. The stones and the woodwork will bear witness that their own security was more important to them than the people that they bulldozed to get these fortresses built. The third woe comes up in verses 12 to 14, and it speaks of violence. They are building their residence on bloodshed, on injustice. Again, we get the sense of a self-centered agenda. That becomes the justification for their maltreatment of others. Greed or pride or now violence are different shades of that same self-centered color. These are people who are living for themselves and themselves alone. That carries through into the fourth woe in verses 15 to 17, which is a reflection of indulgence, heavy drinking to loosen the inhibitions. This becomes the setup for sexual voyeurism. Get them drunk first, and then it's that much easier to get them naked. There's no restraint to their passions. Sin piled upon sin. And their shameless behavior will return on themselves with great shame. Again, it's they're going to get in return the same thing that they were dishing out. The voyeur will become the voyee. It will turn back and they will be forced to drink and be exposed. They'll be the ones covering their privates in shame and disgrace. The first four woes are all related to selfishness. These are people who are at the center of their own universe. So, is it any surprise that the last woe relates to idolatry in verses 18 to 20? When this selfishness runs its course to its logical conclusion, the only God that could fit into that system is a God fashioned by one's own hands. A God made after one's own image, because everything is about self. And if everything is about me, about myself, then the transcendent can't reach any further than my own ego. Any God that would fit into that system would have to be a God that I made, one fashioned by my own pretentious hands. And that's exactly what we find in this fifth woe. But at this point, the silliness of their misplaced trust seems from the outside to be self-evident. Why would you submit to something that you made? Would you really expect a hunk of wood that you've carved into a god or whatever it looks like? But would you really expect a chunk of wood to offer good advice, clear direction, divine favor? It's just wood. That's all it is. Cover it in gold and silver. Make it look real fancy. It's still just a chunk of wood. It's lifeless. It's without breath. And to believe that such a God could wield any power is pretty shallow. So here's the picture that we're getting of these unrighteous Babylonians. They are greedy and arrogant, violent, indulgent, and shallow. A picture of what life is like when the world revolves around oneself. When I am the center of my universe, then why wouldn't I pursue money or security or power or pleasure? But that's a life that is shallow and inconsequential, like making an idol with your hands and expecting it to provide divine guidance and blessing. Dumb. Really dumb. But it's just as foolish to pile up a bunch of money or to spend all your energy protecting yourself and your family from danger, or to chase pleasure with an indulgent lifestyle, or to think that power or influence or popularity is worth more than a stump of wood that you've dubbed God. It's all the same. It's shallow, short-sighted, dumb. And it only makes sense if the world revolves around me. Of course, the world doesn't revolve around me, which does become a small wrench in this machine. 15 verses devoted to the Babylonians and their wickedness, and then just the one phrase to express the alternative, that the righteous will live by faith. Not even a full verse, just a few words. One defining characteristic: they live by faith. But faith implies an object, which suggests that there is something outside of oneself. All this self-absorbed energy of the unrighteous is now being directed by the righteous ones toward God. And that makes all the difference. Notice that it says that the righteous will live by faith. To live by faith is an ongoing commitment. This is a principle of how we live our lives day to day. It pervades all of life. It's not confined to a Sunday morning when we pull ourselves together for some token religiosity. Because if that's the extent of your spirituality, it is not living by faith. Living by faith takes shape on Monday more than it does on Sunday. Faith is this expression of dependence on another. In it, we are overcoming our own tendency towards selfish independence and instead admitting our need for help. The unrighteous, well, they're going to pursue their own pursuits, money and security and power and pleasure, all for selfish gain. But the righteous, well, this is where the contrast is. The righteous, they pursue God, not selfish gain. And this pursuit becomes a lifestyle as encompassing as the unrighteous person's self-centeredness. The righteous one pursues God with that same pervasiveness. It impacts everything. The way that I work and my attitude toward money and the way that I discipline my children or the way that I receive discipline from my parents, my leisure choices, my wardrobe choices, my friendship choices, my music choices, ad infinitum. It goes on and on, impacting everything. Becomes the guiding force in our life choices. So now we're ready to move to Romans, where Paul speaks of righteousness that is by faith from first to last. That's what the NIV says. Literally, it says, by faith to faith. The idea is that faith is bookending this righteousness. By faith at the beginning and to faith at the end, from the first to the last, from A to Z, introduction to conclusion, from the top to the bottom, inside, outside, from every angle, our righteousness at every moment, in every way, is by faith. My righteousness, my right standing before God is tied inseparably to my confidence in God. Faith is the principle that I begin to operate by in life, all day, every day. We remain loyal to God in the midst of discouragement or setback. We treat as sacred the most mundane of acts. We trust that God's plans are best, that His rules are for our well-being, that His forgiveness is inexhaustible, that his purposes are good, that one day in his courts is better than thousands elsewhere, that his steadfast love is better than life. In Rome, there's a church called St. John's Lateran. There's a staircase that is said to be from Pilate's judgment hall. There's 28 marble steps that were said to be relocated from Rome or from Jerusalem to Rome by St. Helena, the mother of Constantine the Great in the 4th century. And the stairs there at this church aren't walked on. There's a separate set of stairs that you can use for walking up. But these stairs are used by pilgrims who mount these steps on their knees. And each step, they're expected to pray the Father's prayer. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Every step, they pray the Lord's prayer. At certain points, there are stains that have been covered in glass to protect them. And those stains are said to be blood that dripped from Christ when he was taken out of Pilate's hall. Pilgrims will stop at those points and kiss the glass as they pray. And the church taught that if someone ascended those stairs on hands and knees, prayed the Lord's Prayer at each step, then by the time you reached the top, a soul from purgatory would be released. So Luther, in the midst of this great spiritual turmoil, came to this church as a pilgrim to perform this rite. And when he reached the top, he looked back on those 28 steps that he had just descended, hands and knees, with prayer surrounding him. And it tells us that he said to himself, "What if it's not so? How could climbing a set of stairs be the key to someone's release from judgment? It seemed to Luther so arbitrary." His son tells us that the words of the prophet Habakkuk came to his mind at this point. "The just shall live by faith." And this was part of his awakening to the realization that it is not any work of our doing that brings righteousness. Not even climbing a set of stairs on hands and knees. It's faith that makes us righteous. Faith in the finished work of Christ. Faith alone. So let's say God demands absolute righteousness for acceptance, right? That he doesn't grade on a scale, and that this is a pass-fail kind of exam, and a passing grade is 100%. Get one question wrong, even a multiple choice question, and you still fail. So you have the really bad person who's like a convict on death row and he's got a long rap sheet. Let's say they fulfilled 5% of the righteousness required. 5%. Well, they get a failing grade. Obviously, they get a failing grade. Only a 5%, of course they're going to get a failing grade. And then you've got the normal kind of law-abiding citizen, average neighbor. Maybe they do as much as 50% of what's required. And that may be questionable, 50-50, you know, if you're putting it on a scale, depends on what your grading scale is, but boy, that seems pretty close. Unless, of course, you're going with the standard that the only passing grade is 100%. In that case, the guy with 50%, guess what? He fails, just like the person with 5%. But let's say you have somebody who's really, he's a pretty good person. I mean, they really go out of their way to help the poor and, you know, help the needy, and they're very generous and kind, and they don't, you know, do anything that's unseemly, and they may get to 80%, maybe 85%, maybe even 90%. It's rare that every once in a while they have a slip up. It's pretty rare, but You know, occasionally they do, but for the most part, they're really good. They're into the high 80s, maybe low 90s in their percentage. Well, guess what? If the standard is you need 100% to pass and you get a 90%, then what happens? You fail. You fail just like the person who got the 5% or the person who got the 50%. Even if you got 98%, you still fail. And this is what happens, that there's this understanding, and this is what Romans is making the point, that our righteousness doesn't come by our own efforts, because when we make our own efforts, we are always graded to a point where we are less than 100%, that we fail in some regard. And God says, because of that, you get a failing grade. We like to think that God will just fill in the gap. So let's say the guy who gets 5%, they need a lot of God. God's going to have to fill in the other 95% for them. And the person who has 50%, well, it's an even split with God. You know, they bring their 50%, and then God is going to throw in the other 50%, and between the two of them, they'll get 100%. And the person who's maybe 80, 85, 90% of the way there, well, they don't need a lot. They just need God to kind of top off the tank to finish off the rest. They just need that last 15% or 10%. But that's not the way that things work. No matter what percentage we bring with us, we need to realize that it's all worthless because we can't compartmentalize it. The tainted part ends up spoiling the whole. So even 80%, 90% righteousness, that little 10 or 20% of unrighteousness, it spoils the whole thing. That's why Romans makes the point that our righteousness comes by faith to faith, from faith from first to last. It's not our good works that get us there. It's His righteousness that does it. From beginning to end. It's not as if I start with my righteousness and then He ends with my putting my faith in Him for the rest. My righteousness comes by faith from beginning to end, all the way through. 100% of it is because of what Christ has done for me. So, instead of working together, we have to look at our own righteousness and call it what it is. They're filthy rags, as it's told to us. That we reject any self-centered ideals that I can do any part in this. And see that as the stuff that is selfish. The very things that Habakkuk talks about as a characteristic of the unrighteous person. Self-centeredness. And the realization that I can't do it on my own. That I don't have anything to offer. Not one scrap comes from my own effort. One of the rallying cries of the Reformation was the Latin phrase, sola fide, which translated means faith alone. It's the expression of this conviction that it is faith from first to last. Faith and faith alone. It's the way that I'm made righteous. Faith alone, not works of the law, not human righteousness, not baptism, not almsgiving, not penance, not good intentions, not climbing staircases, not purchasing indulgences, not anything else that we could conceive of, but faith, and faith alone. Complete reliance on another to do what I can't do myself. Well, for Luther's convictions, he was excommunicated, cast out of the church. Church splintered and the Protestantism was born. And sometimes it takes hundreds of years for vindication to come. But it did come in this case. On November 19th, 2008, Pope Benedict XVI made a pretty surprising proclamation. He said this: Luther's expression, sola fide, is true if faith is not opposed to charity, to love. And of course, it's not. It's not opposed to charity, to love. The just living by faith is in direct contrast to those who are living for selfish gains. And the antithesis to selfishness, beginning with that recognition that I can't justify myself, is love. Hundreds of years later, the Catholic Church recognized that what Luther was teaching in faith alone didn't run contrary to Scripture. It is faithful to the Word of God. That our righteousness is dependent on faith and faith alone. Once a month we celebrate the Lord's table. This is the Sunday that we do so. And the Lord's table is an opportunity for us to be brought back to that conviction. What is the substance of our faith? That our righteousness is not based on any works that I may do. It's based on the sacrifice of Christ. And so we come and we look at two elements, little pieces of bread broken, symbols of Christ's body broken for us, and then little cups of juice representing his blood shed for us, because it is in those things, not anything in myself, but in those things, his sacrifice, that I find forgiveness for all my sin, that his righteousness becomes my righteousness, that I don't have to get to 80% or 50% or whatever percentage, that I can trust fully in his righteousness to cover me. So when we celebrate this, we're brought back to that, reminded of the substance of our faith. These symbols become representations for us, to bring us back to that moment when we first believed, so that we don't lose sight of our first love. If you're reading in our Encounter with God readings, we provide a reading guide. Booklets are on the back if you're interested. But this last week we were in Jeremiah. And if you were reading those, you remember that we read